I'm Bob Doty reporting. Macedonia announced Friday that it would allow in a limited number of illegal migrants from vulnerable categories after riot police confronted angry crowds of migrants stranded in a no-man's land at the border with Greece. Macedonia did not say what the vulnerable categories were. The Reuters news agency reported Friday that hundreds of migrants had crossed the border from Greece into Macedonia. Earlier in the day, riot police used tear gas, stun grenades, and barriers of barbed wire to hold back the crowds of migrants who had surged during the night, demanding they be allowed to pass through Macedonia to European Union countries. The move stranded at least 1,500 men, women, and children in the no-man's land between the two countries. Nearly all of the migrants are from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced Friday he would call snap elections after the failure of coalition talks and a rise in tensions over military action against Kurdish rebels. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu had abandoned efforts to form a coalition government earlier this week when talks ended with two smaller parties. Political analysts say discontent has been growing because of renewed fighting with the PKK Kurdish rebel group. Mr. Erdogan, who suffered a rare setback in inconclusive June polls, said he would meet the parliament speaker on Monday to make arrangements and formally call new elections, likely for the 1st of November. Mr. Davutoglu's AKP lost its 12-year majority rule in the June elections, mainly due to success of the newly created pro-Kurdish HDP. This is VOA News. Europeans have offered a mixed reaction to Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras' resignation and call for new elections. Some analysts and politicians are cautiously upbeat, but many investors are wary about the fallout. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
After weeks of turmoil, Greeks awoke to more uncertainty on Friday with Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras' call for snap elections. Prime Minister Tsipras says he hopes new elections will give him a stronger majority with which to govern. Christian Odendaal, the chief economist with the London-based Center for European Reform, says he thinks it's a gamble that will pay off.
He is still the most popular politician in Greece. So even though the Greek voters are surely frustrated with the situation, Tsipras will remain their first choice.
Mr. Tsipras's announcement came a day after Germany's parliament approved tough bailout conditions for Greece. He's called for snap elections on September 20th. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Afghan officials say Taliban insurgents ambushed the convoy of Vice President General Abdul Rashid Dostum Friday afternoon, but that he escaped the attack unharmed. Dostum's spokesman, Sultan Faizi, said the general's men returned fire, killing 8 attackers. Another 13 were arrested. Dostum is a former warlord with a strong following among Afghanistan's Uzbek ethnic minority. He has been fighting the Taliban in his northern stronghold in recent weeks. Afghan authorities say Taliban insurgents have linked up with the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan to strengthen their campaign across the previously peaceful province. Israeli airstrikes on the Syrian-controlled portion of the Golan Heights have killed at least 5 unarmed civilians, according to Syrian state media, in what Israel says was retaliation for rocket fire into its territory. Israel says those killed were Palestinian militants from the Islamic Jihad militant group. The drone strike targeted a car near a market in Al-Qom village early Friday. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a Britain-based group that monitors the Syrian war, confirmed the attack. Israeli military officials say the strike was targeted at those responsible for firing rockets into Israel's Galilee region Thursday. Ceremonies were held Friday at the Bangkok shrine hit by this week's deadly bombing as Thai officials continued to make confusing statements about the search for the attackers. High-ranking Thai officials and religious figures attended the multi-faith ceremony to remember the 22 people killed in Monday's bombing at the Erawan Shrine, the country's worst attack in recent memory. Authorities have stepped up security patrols at tourist sites. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Cameroon and Central African Republic officials are asking truck drivers protesting the killing of 18 of their colleagues in fresh rebel attacks to go back to work. The drivers are condemning persistent harassment from both rebels and CAR government officials.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details coming up.
Also, the Boko Haram insurgency has displaced nearly 1.5 million people in Nigeria alone.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, three soldiers with the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, have been indicted in connection with the killing of Somali civilians last month. VOA's Steve Barragona has the story.
African Union forces killed seven civilians on July 31st in the Somali town of Marka, said AMISOM Chief Maman Sidiku at a press conference in Nairobi on Friday.
This incident has happened. It's tragic. It's terrible. It's going to be investigated thoroughly.
Human Rights Watch says that in the July 31st incident, Ugandan soldiers entered several houses after a nearby bomb attack on an AMISOM convoy. It says that in one house where a wedding was taking place, the soldiers separated the men from the women and shot six men, four brothers, their father, and an uncle. It was not clear who was the seventh victim, Sidiku mentioned. Three Ugandan peacekeepers were indicted for violating rules of engagement, he said. AMISOM Commander Lieutenant General Jonathan Rono said his forces in Marka are under frequent attack from Islamist group Al-Shabaab, but operate under strict protocols.
The environment we are operating, of course you are aware, is a very difficult one, but all said and done, these instructions are there, and our job is to make sure they are followed.
There have been several recent reports of AMISOM peacekeepers killing Somali civilians. Sidiku said all are being investigated. Sidiku said the Somali military, local and federal governments, and the Marka community will take part in the investigation of the incident. It is expected to take about 2 weeks. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Boko Haram insurgency has displaced nearly 1.5 million people in Nigeria alone. Tens of thousands of refugees have sought safety in camps in the neighboring Lake Chad region, including Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Resources to feed and provide medical care for the displaced are being provided by UNICEF and by NGOs, including Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym, MSF. Mokhtar Dauda Abbas is the group's emergency coordinator in Nigeria. Reporter William Eagle asked for an update on the situation in Borno State, called the epicenter of the fighting.
Borno State remains the epicenter of the current conflict, and the situation continues to be extremely volatile and tense. Random attacks occur regularly, mostly targeting civilians. Since May 2013, a violent incident prompted by the Islamic group Boko Haram has led to a displacement of and a ground humanitarian crisis in the Lake Chad region. According to the United Nations and IOM, approximately 1.5 million people have been internally displaced in northeast Nigeria.
How many people are in refugee camps in Borno?
600,000. Today we are talking about around 6,100 people in Maiduguri. And among them, around 80,000 are living within 15 camps.
What are the main needs of the people in the camps?
The need is food, shelter, health, water, and sanitation.
Does MSF provide also water, food, and sanitation, or are you limited to medical assistance?
Currently, MSF opened three primary health care clinics covering around 35,000 people. And An additional MSF is running a 72-bed hospital in Maimoussari clinics, which including 12 beds in maternity and 60 beds for the pediatric nutrition and intensive care. And also regular donations are also made to local hospitals in order for them to deal with mass casualty following bombing attacks. MSF is providing water and sanitation in six camps. And also MSF provide as well mental health support to the survivor of the conflict.
What are most people in the camps being treated for?
It's most about malnutrition, pregnant women, and under 5 children.
What is the effect of the rainy season?
Yes, currently we are aware about cholera outbreak because we know that about the crowdness within the camp for the IDPs, and we know that Maiduguri is also an epidemic place, and now we are in the rainy season. So
the government says that that Boko Haram is near defeat. Is that affecting the number of people that are still refugees coming to the camps?
Since some days ago, 2 weeks, we can say that the returnees who have come from Cameroon, and also with the operational plan, military operational plan, so we have also many IDPs who are coming back in the Maiduguri town also within the camp.
What do you need today, immediately?
Yes, of course. All the organizations to take care about food, NFI, shelters, and also water and sanitation. The need is really huge in Northwest, mostly in Borno State, to increase the efforts of NGO in Borno State.
That's Mokhtar Daouda Abbas of Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking from Nigeria with reporter William Eagle.
Well, Cameroon and Central African Republic officials are asking truck drivers protesting the killing of 18 of their colleagues in fresh rebel attacks to go back to work. The drivers are condemning persistent harassment from both rebels and CAR government officials. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
CAR Transport Minister Arnaud Jobaye Abazene says a food and humanitarian crisis looms as truck drivers have for 2 weeks refused to transport goods from the Douala seaport in Cameroon to Bangui, capital of his landlocked country.
Le gouvernement centrafricain et la MINUSCA vont prendre toutes les mesures nécessaires pour assurer leur sécurité.
He says his government has sent him to assure Cameroon truck drivers that they have agreed with forces of the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Central African Republic, MINUSCA, to assure their protection. Robin Kille, Cameroon's Minister of Transport, says the drivers are protesting the killing of 18 transport workers within 2 weeks. He says rebels from neighboring CAR have also killed several Cameroonians recently.
There is no driver who can accept to go to Bangui because of that situation, that problem of insecurity. We had a meeting several times, but no major solution. I asked him to insist on the action of MINUSCA to protect any Cameroonian who has decided to go there. If we do it, there will be no problem.
Landlocked CAR depends on supplies exclusively from Cameroon's seaport of Douala, which Libom Lilikeng, Cameroon's customs chief, says is already congested with food and humanitarian assistance destined for troubled CAR.
Nous sommes là pour trouver une solution pour que ces camions déjà chargés puissent aller effectivement.
She says she is at Douala to negotiate with the drivers so that the goods should be taken to Bangui and ease the congestion at the seaport. El Hajj Umaru, president of the drivers' union, says they are not only targeted by rebels. He says they are also harassed by CAR officials who accuse them of transporting dangerous goods and weapons used by the rebels.
Nous pouvons malencontreusement, peut-être par inadvertance, porter un objet dangereux sans se rendre compte.
He says some of them can erroneously or without knowing transport dangerous objects and weapons. He says he has been telling all truck drivers to be vigilant and inform the military should they find out that someone is transporting goods he is not supposed to transport. CAR descended into chaos in March 2013 when Muslim Seleka rebels toppled François Bozizé's government, leading to reprisals from Christians who formed anti-Balaka militias. 90% of imports and exports and all humanitarian aid and supplies for MINUSCA forces transit through Douala. The truck drivers say they will not resume work if their security is not assured and if five drivers held hostage or arrested on suspicion of transporting dangerous goods are not released. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Associated Press says at least eight migrants were injured when Macedonian riot police fired stun grenades and tear gas canisters into angry crowds stranded in a no-man's land between Greece and Macedonia. The crowd of about 3,000 migrants was trying to pass through Macedonia and Serbia by train and on foot to resettle in Germany and other European countries. The migrants spent last night out in the open and tried several times to break through the police blockades. Macedonia called for a state of emergency yesterday and sent riot troops to prevent increasing numbers of migrants from entering the country. Around 2,000 migrants a day have been crossing into Macedonia from Greece. Most of the migrants are fleeing war, terrorism and poverty in Afghanistan, Iraq and Syria. The UN says more than 160,000 migrants have arrived in Greece so far this year.
Germany's interior minister has criticized Europe's failure to solve the refugee crisis. Thomas de Maizière says EU delays in managing the crisis are not acceptable and threatened passport-free travel within the EU community. Germany has criticized Greece and Italy, where most of the migrants first land, for failure to follow an EU rule that migrants must be registered in the first European country of entry. De Maizière says the EU must put a stop to the free flow of migrants. He proposes the EU create waiting zones in Italy and Greece, agree on a common definition of asylum and safe countries of origin, and link development aid to countries willing to accept the return of migrants. Germany has welcomed tens of thousands of refugees arriving each month, but is concerned that a predicted total of 800,000 arrivals in 2015 is not sustainable.
Last night on a beach in Freetown, Sierra Leone, a candlelight vigil was held for a teenager found murdered last week. The death has sparked outrage in the country and concern about rising crime in the wake of the Ebola epidemic. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
The body of 17-year-old Hannah Bokeri was found earlier this month on the well-known Lumley Beach. Tests will determine whether she was sexually assaulted, but police and a women's group say it appears she was. She may have been beaten to death. Nikki Spencer-Coker is spokeswoman for Power Women 232, a group of professional women that organized the vigil. She says outrage over the teen's death erupted when a picture of her body was circulated on social media.
This young person who clearly had died violently, now being violated and victimized a second time by her picture being circulated throughout social media. So this does not seem like something that we should sit by and allow to go unreported on, unspoken about. It needed to be something that we needed to raise our voices about to let people know that it wasn't okay with us as citizens of this country, as women, to allow something like this to go unchallenged.
She says circulating the picture of the crime scene disrespected who Bokeri was.
That was somebody's child, somebody's sister, somebody's daughter, and her young life was cut short in a fairly brutal manner, whether or not she was raped. So we held this candlelight vigil in March. We're very, very happy about the fact that we've received so much support and involvement from various individuals and organizations, because it means that something we hope will be done, not just for Hannah, but for other victims of violence and sexual assault in Sierra Leone.
She says police and civil society groups reported an increase in crime, including sexual assaults, as Ebola strained government resources. However, no official figures are available yet.
I think it was incumbent on us as citizens to put pressure on the police, on the security forces, to ensure that if they need to pressure somebody else to get what they need to ensure that we as citizens are protected, that they do so. There's been reports of an increase of attacks on people along certain tourist attractions. The police have been responding in terms of increased checkpoints and making the public aware, but clearly more needs to be done.
Power Women 232 is calling for greater funding for the police department's family support unit and for forensic evidence kits to investigate crime scenes. It also wants more and better trained police officers in Sierra Leone. Spencer Coker also says average citizens must use social media responsibly.
Social media really can be a tool for good or ill. And this is not the first time that something like this has been reported about. In fact, since we started raising our voices on this particular case, people were coming forward and saying, well, this has happened and that had happened. What was most disturbing was the fact that her picture was so widely shared in social media outlets, and it just bothered people no end. She didn't deserve to die the way she did, and she didn't deserve to have her picture distributed the way it was.
She says Hannah Bokery was not a street child. She had family. She had friends. The vigil was held on the eve of her 18th birthday. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The 25th anniversary of the Ryan White Comprehensive AIDS Resources Emergency Act was recognized this week. The act, named for the young man who was diagnosed with AIDS at the age of 13 following a blood transfusion. Prior to his death in 1990, Ryan fought discrimination based on his illness in his community in Indiana. Legislation to honor him and support others with HIV/AIDS was passed soon after his death. Today, the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program has provided comprehensive care for more than nearly 525,000 low-income people living with HIV. Dr. Laura Cheever is a physician and associate administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the Health Resources and Services Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She spoke with me about how the program has improved the lives of so many people living with the virus.
The purpose of the program is to provide HIV care and treatment for people infected with HIV who don't have resources to get those services on their own. We're really a unique program in that we provide medical care services, things like doctor's visits, medication, laboratory visits, as well as the critical essential support services people need to engage in care and stay in care. So we provide transportation to medical visits. We provide intensive case management, and those types of services that people, particularly poor people, need to get the care they need.
What are some examples of communities that you all work in?
We work nationally. We fund all 50 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, the Pacific jurisdiction. So we work across the United States. Certainly all the major cities that are heavily impacted by HIV, cities like Dallas and Houston and Los Angeles and Tampa and New York City, Chicago, are all cities we work in. But we also work in small rural communities throughout the country, particularly in places where the epidemic is more rurally located, such as throughout the South.
How has treatment changed over the past 25 years?
25 years ago, when someone was diagnosed with HIV, particularly if they were diagnosed late with AIDS, they had a terrible prognosis. Most people with AIDS lived 6 months or less. Today, if people are diagnosed, particularly if they're diagnosed early and get into care and remain on treatment, they can live a near normal lifespan. So the face of the disease has completely changed in the last 25 years.
What are some of the main drugs that are used now for treatment?
We have many, many drugs to treat HIV today. We have several different classes of drugs. We call them highly active antiretroviral therapy. And when we treat people with HIV, we use a combination of three different drugs. Sometimes those drugs can be co-formulated into one pill. Other times people need to take several different medications a day.
I wanted to just talk a little bit about the person that really got this whole thing started, the young man, Ryan White, who contracted HIV/AIDS through a blood transfusion. He subsequently passed away from complications from AIDS, but he also, during his fight with AIDS, he also was fighting something else too, and that was AIDS-related discrimination. What was that like for him, and what is that like today?
When Ryan White was first diagnosed with HIV, there was just a lot of fear in his community. He was initially not allowed to go to school. With his family, particularly with his mother, fought for his right to go to school. That was really one of the main things that he wanted to do in his life. In some ways, the issues around discrimination against HIV have gotten a lot better in this country. People do have rights in terms of living with HIV and being allowed to attend school and work. However, there's still a huge amount of stigma in the community, and many people, once they're diagnosed, do not seek services because of the stigma around being HIV infected. So it continues to be a problem today, not at the same level as Ryan White. He did a huge amount of work in his lifetime, and he really has a legacy to be proud of.
How do you get people to overcome their fear of people with HIV/AIDS?
I think the most important thing to help people overcome their fear is to get good education. Someone is not going to get HIV by drinking water out of the glass someone has used, or by sharing a bathroom, or by hugging a person with HIV. And so I think it is important to explain how HIV is transmitted, that it really is through very close personal contact, sexual contact, sharing of needles, and it's not going to happen in a casual relationship or by sharing a house with someone.
Looking ahead in the future, where do you see HIV/AIDS? Will it continue to be a part of people's lives, or be substantially reduced, or just eradicated?
For all of us, our wish is that we could eradicate HIV. NIH is working on, is it possible to cure HIV? At this point in time, it's not a possibility. But we do know that if someone is successfully treated, they will live a near normal lifespan, which is great news for them. But also, their risk of transmitting HIV to someone else is virtually zero. So if we can really get people identified through testing, into care, on effective treatment, then we can really do a lot to reduce the epidemic.
That was Dr. Laura Cheever, a physician and associate administrator for the HIV/AIDS Bureau at the Health Resources and Services Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Three soldiers with the African Union mission in Somalia, AMISOM, have been indicted in connection with the killing of Somali civilians. And the Boko Haram insurgency has displaced nearly 1.5 million people in Nigeria alone. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and in our feature segment, the final report on the Eritrean migration. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand World Championship Athletics once again tops your sports report.
Kim, the 15th IAAF World Championships in Athletics officially begin Saturday in Beijing, China. The 9-day competition is being staged at the Beijing National Stadium, nicknamed the Bird's Nest. This will be the largest sporting event to take place at the facility since the 2008 Olympics. The stadium has a seating capacity of 91,000. The IAAF's outgoing president, Senegal's Lamine Diack, says he's delighted to report that the Bird's Nest will be full for all the evening sessions and will be at around 90% capacity for the morning sessions. Look for a few African athletes to win medals on Saturday's opening day of action. There will be finals in the men's 10,000 meters and the men's marathon. Mark Ouma has this preview for us.
Ugandan defending champion Stephen Kiprotich seeks to retain his marathon title in the first event at the IAAF World Athletics Championships, which starts in Beijing, China tomorrow Saturday. His main challengers are Ethiopian Lelisa Desisa, a silver medalist at the last World Championships, Kenya's Olympic silver medalist Wilson Kipsang, and world record holder Dennis Kimeto. Staying in Beijing, South Africa's Stephen Mokoka aims for a better result in his third consecutive 10,000 meters at the World Championships. He gives an insight into his frame of mind.
If you could look at the history of me in terms of world championships. I come from Daegu. I got a one lap, and then 2 years later, I went to Moscow. I was in a race. I could manage to stay with the guys till the last 8 kilometers. That's when they moved away from me. But when I finished, they were like 150 meters to go away from me. I'm hoping to improve on that, because the only way is I always take myself as my own opponent, and then I always look at my level. So for me, I'm not even going to be a factor on the race. The most important thing is to see whether I'm developing, and then I'm improving as much as I can. For me to finish like on the home straight with the guys, it will be a great achievement for me. I mean, to look at the history where I started in terms of track and field. So my main goal is to see improving from my previous competition in terms of championships.
That was Stephen Mokoka, the South African 10,000 meter champion, speaking in Beijing, China.
Something to crow about, VOA sports fans. It's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Undefeated Floyd Mayweather has made his next fight. He'll take on the Haitian Andre Berto September 12th. But first, Nnamdi, let's look back at Mayweather's last fight, the much ballyhooed bout against Manny Pacquiao. The final numbers for that fight, Nnamdi, are they in?
Sonny, the final numbers are in, but part of these numbers were kept away from the public. Floyd Mayweather made $220 million for that fight, just for stepping into the ring and fighting. But remember also, he is the co-promoter of the fight with Bob Arum. So hidden from the public was the amount he made from being the co-promoter. He made $150 million. So at $150 million plus $220 million, talking about more than crazy paper.
He's banking for sure.
Oh, serious banking, bro.
Namdi, why Berto? I mean, there were some other bigger names available for Mayweather to fight.
For us, you have the American who talked up him fighting Mayweather for a long time. He pushed for the fight. Then you have your Danny Garcia. You have your Keith Thurman. But all these guys, they are okay. I mean, American in his last fight with Aguirre, he struggled and he's okay. He's a big talker, but he just wouldn't give Mayweather the kind of fight Mayweather wants for his last fight, which he claims to be. American will move and run, and that's not what we want. Keith Thurman almost got knocked out in his backyard in his last fight. Andre Berto is an explosive puncher, former world champion. He comes to fight, and I don't know why the media and the public just don't care for this fight.
What have the ticket sales been like for what Mayweather says will be his last fight?
Well, like I said, the media really killed this fight. The media never really gave this fight any love at all. If you're talking about walking money, I mean, you're looking about like $231 for just to walk into the venue compared to $5,000 for the Manny Pacquiao fight. The love is not there, really.
Namdi, Floyd Mayweather called Manny Pacquiao a sore loser after Pac-Man complained of a shoulder injury after his unanimous decision loss. What's the Pac-Man's health like these days?
Well, he claims he's ready to go and he will fight in the beginning of the year. And they're talking about taking him to Dubai to fight Amir Khan. Both were once trained by Freddie Roach. And they were both sparring partners. So any big demand for American versus Manny Pacquiao may be in the Middle East with Dubai with big money. But I still don't like that fight.
Why don't you like it, Namdi?
American has this style we call jab and grab. Jab and grab style. Another apostle of jab and grab is Wladimir Klitschko, you know that guy. They will jab you and they will hold you, they grab you, they will run. And fight fans don't want that style. It's a boring style. American against Manny Pacquiao. Pacquiao will face the same trouble he faced with Floyd Mayweather, trying to cut off the ring. He'll be not able to cut off the ring. And American will win easy, one-sided fight, which will make Manny Pacquiao Mayweather 2 impossible. VOA!
Namdi, how about an update for our VOA boxing fans about some of the top Africans who have been in the ring recently or are getting into the ring?
The boys have not been really doing good. The boys have been robbed. We have Fred Cassie from Douala, Cameroon. This right on television a Saturday afternoon against Chris Ariola, Mexican-American, in El Paso. It's like fighting a man in his living room. If you don't really destroy him or beat him up, his family and everybody's watching, you can't win, you know. So at the end of 10 rounds, they call it a majority draw. Mm. What? Fred Cassie beats Chris Ariola 96-94 on my scorecard, and that was just a plain robbery on a Saturday afternoon.
Mm.
The same case with Wally Omotosho against Sammy Vasquez. Omotosho had Vasquez all bloodied up and bruised up, and they called it a unanimous decision. Though Omotosho gave away the early rounds, but Omotosho finished the fight strong, you know, and I was not happy with that decision too. We have Sharif Bogari from Uganda. Sharif really need to make a move now because injuries and not fighting the right guys will not bring him the money he needs to make because he was supposed to be on the card here in L.A. and he pulled out because of injuries. And I'm being told now he's got a fight in Cancun, but who's going to see the fight in Cancun? It's a meaningless fight. He needs to come back to the U.S., go back on TV like he used to do in the past, and destroy guys, and he'd be lined for a world title fight. Fighting in the backyard in Mexico, he can get robbed.
Namdi, in 3 months, on November 21st, a fight that caught my eye, Miguel Cotto versus the red-headed Mexican Canelo. How's this one shaping up?
This could be the biggest all-action fight of the year, and maybe fight of the year. You have two knockout artists, which we call a Picasso right here. Cotto is... In 44 fights, he has 33 knockouts. Canelo, in 47 fights, he has 32 knockouts. And, you know, this big rivalry between Mexico and Puerto Rico. Go back to the days of Salvador Sanchez against Wilfredo Gomez. I mean, these two countries, they are the biggest boxing fans. and you have the two superstars from these two countries ready to clash for the WBC middleweight title. And check this, Sonny, it's going to be at a catch weight, which is 155 pounds, which is 5 pounds lower than the 160 for a middleweight.
So it sounds like lots of action and maybe last man standing, Namdi?
Don't go to your fridge.
Thanks, Namdi. I won't go to the fridge. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta. Turning to tennis, Swiss star Roger Federer trounced South Africa's Kevin Anderson 6-1 and 6-1 to reach the quarterfinals of the Cincinnati Masters tournament in the U.S. state of Ohio. I mentioned during Thursday's Sunny Side of Sports that Anderson faced a daunting challenge in Federer, winner of a record 17 Grand Slam singles titles, and Federer was in top form, putting on a clinic in ousting Anderson. Hey, Roger, how does it feel to beat the world's 15th ranked men's player?
It's a great feeling when you know you can beat top 10, top 20 players frequently, but then also sometimes with a scoreline like this, maybe not 1-1, but you know, like something convincing where you feel like you're in control the whole time. That gives you definitely a lot of confidence going forward.
Going forward, Roger Federer will face Spain's Feliciano Lopez in the quarterfinals in Cincinnati. In the other quarterfinal matchups, world number one Novak Djokovic of Serbia will play Stan Wawrinka of Switzerland. Alex Dolgopolov of Ukraine will meet Tomas Berdych of the Czech Republic. And Frenchman Richard Gasquet will take on Britain's Andy Murray. This Cincinnati hardcourt tournament is a warm-up event for the U.S. Open in New York, the year's final Grand Slam competition. The U.S. Open gets underway August 31st in New York City. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. And here's a quick shout-out for one of my Facebook friends, Fred Alambo, who sent me a Facebook message saying he tunes in via shortwave radio in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. Wishing Fred and all our VOA listeners a happy and sporty weekend. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the final in our series on Eritrean migration. And next, the campaign to rid the world of polio being hampered. But for some music, here is Penny Penny of South Africa with Shaka Bandu.
Allah, what's your head in the head? I ain't shaka bundu yo.
Penny Penny of South Africa with Shaka Bundu.
In Eritrea's mass exodus, all signs lead to Italy. Migrants who make it survive the Sahara, kidnappers who rape and hold them for ransom, jihadists who would cut off their heads, and small leaky boats that sink in the Mediterranean. Some who survive will meet Father Musi Zare, a Father Moses who rescues them with a cell phone call and leads them through Europe's political minefield. For his refugee work, Father Musi has been nominated by his supporters for the UN Refugee Agency's Nansen Award and the Nobel Peace Prize. In the final report on the Eritrean migration, Father Musi talked to VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C. about challenges in Europe's promised land.
The recent explosion of migrants from Africa and Syria gained international attention last year. But for 40-year-old Musi Zarai, it began in the early 1990s, when he left home as a youth. Father Musi is now a parish priest in a Catholic diocese in Switzerland. He is also the unofficial ambassador for thousands of migrants who fled from Eritrea, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Somalia. His cell phone number is scrawled on the hulls of boats that carry their human cargoes to Europe. Migrants from throughout the Horn of Africa call him when their boats begin to flounder and sink in the Mediterranean.
Time by time, finally, I become public figure and like one of main points for asylum seekers and refugees from Horn Africa, especially for Eritreans, because even me, I am Eritrean. Even me, when I come for the first time to Europe, I came like asylum seeker, refugee.
When Musi fled from Asmara, Eritrea was still fighting for its independence from the Marxist regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam of Ethiopia. From Rome, he has watched the rebirth of Eritrea and has been disappointed.
Eritrea is one of these countries, leaks, really is a failed state because the government, the regime in Eritrea is totally authoritarian, totally despotic. So why? These people is obligate to escape from the country because no, we don't have even constitution.
Father Musi started to help African migrants in 1995. He began getting calls for help on his cell phone 5 years later. He created the Agencia Habesha website for his rescue work. He helps identify the dead, visits detention centers in Italy, meets with members of European parliaments and European Union commissioners. And in the spring, when the weather is good for sailing, he starts getting the calls.
I received some distress call, especially from two boats. The first one with 600 refugees or asylum seekers. The second one is with around 450 people. So finally, more than 1,000. When I received this distress call, I informed the Italian Coast Guard, the Maltese Coast Guard, and the other organization like UNHCR. So we all try to follow up the process of rescue.
More immigrants continue to reach European shores. In the past 6 months, the International Office for Migration and the UN Refugee Agency have estimated more than 150,000 migrants have landed in Europe. Father Musi has lobbied migration officials and legislators in Rome and in the European Union in Brussels to argue for a humane policy for the settlement of the migrants. But he says Europe has its own political problems.
For a long time, the European Union, he don't see this problem like the European problem. He look like only problem of Italy, problem of Greece, problem of Spain.
Migrants land in Italy and Greece because these countries claim the shores of the Mediterranean and they are Europe's frontline states for the Africa migration. The European Union maintains that the first country you reach must take you in, even though or because Eritrea was once an Italian colony. Eritreans prefer the Scandinavian countries where relatives and liberal refugee policies welcome them.
Now the new agenda of the European Union, he talk about these 40,000 asylum seekers we can transfer legally, relocation to other North European countries. Yes, many countries like England, Denmark, France, even some of these Eastern European countries, he don't accept this, even Spain. He want to start to rebuilding his new life in the country where we want to reach the other family members, maybe in Sweden, in Norway, in Holland or Germany.
Echoing the arguments of other European champions of migrants, Father Moussi says Africa's migrants can help Europe's troubled economies.
We know the demography of many European countries is very low because the people of the European Union is more oldest, so we need the fresh new energy to involve in this development program, in the industries, in agriculture, all these sectors. So it's necessary to give more opportunity for this very poorest country. Even if you want to do some agreement to send back the migrant workers, it's necessary to invest in the origin country for these people to create jobs in the homeland.
Earlier in the discussions, EU commissioners considered why so many Africans are leaving their homelands.
Even in my discussion with the European country MP or with the commissioners, I discussed even about these migrant workers. So why I asked to the European Union, especially when I have the occasion to discuss with the commissioners, I asked them, first step is necessary to go to the homeland of these countries to find the solution in the root of the problem.
The European policy debate divides migrants into those who flee for their lives and those who pursue jobs. Father Moussi believes Eritreans and many others from Africa fall into the first category.
Asylum seekers, he don't escape from the country with the plan to go to Europe. He escaped only to save his life.
For the European Migration Dilemma, Father Moussi and some officials in the European Union Commission have a solution. Persuade Europe's political leaders to help the countries like Eritrea to ease economic burdens and create jobs. This is David Arnold for VOA in Washington, D.C.
In recent years, the international campaign to rid the world of polio has been hampered in some Muslim countries by claims from some clerics that the polio vaccine is really an undercover campaign to sterilize Muslim children. Now, an anti-polio campaign in Kenya is meeting opposition from another direction, Kenya's Catholic bishops, who are calling on the faithful to boycott the vaccine in that country. Lenny Ruvaga has more on the story.
Mid-morning in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Workers from the Ministry of Health are doing rounds, immunizing children against polio. Mary Samula, a teacher, welcomes the team into her home, eager to get her newborn, Chantel, immunized. The first round of the campaign ended August 5th, and the Ministry of Health says it's on its way toward achieving its goal of reaching 6 million children when the campaign ends September 2nd. Despite calls by the Catholic Church to reject the vaccine, Samula, who is Catholic, welcomes it.
I'd like my baby to be immunized because I don't want my child to be paralyzed. That's the first thing. And also, I listen to my own voice. I like my baby to grow up as a normal child.
As the campaign was beginning, Kenya's Catholic bishops called for a boycott of the polio vaccine, saying it has not been thoroughly tested. The bishops also said the vaccines were birth control in disguise. They had raised similar objections earlier this year to a tetanus vaccination campaign.
We are in a status where now we must be able to kind of determine our own destiny.
But Dr. Nicholas Muraguri, the Health Ministry's Director of Medical Services, says the bishop's concerns are baseless.
The polio vaccine that has been used this campaign from 1st to 5th August is safe. It has gone through all the quality assurance system, including our own confirmation in our own laboratories that the vaccine is safe.
Catholic officials contacted by VOA elsewhere in the world would not comment specifically on the Kenya bishop's position, saying only that local church leaders have a responsibility to protect their congregations. But writings from Catholic church leaders approve of vaccines and see them both as a way to protect individual lives and public health.
Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including the Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net, or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
News is happening. VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
From Washington, this is VOA News.